Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. U.S. and Taliban agree in principle to peace framework. American and Taliban officials have agreed in principle to the framework of a deal in which the insurgents would guarantee Afghan territory is never used by terrorists, which could lead to a full pullout of American troops in return for larger concessions from the Taliban. This, according to the chief United States negotiator. What does this really mean? Is this more sizzle than steak? Well, for this, we turn to my first guest. He is the director of Afghan and Pakistan Studies at the Middle East Institute, Dr. Marvin G. Weinbaum. Dr. Weinbaum, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you.
So there are a lot of moving parts here. What do we know and what's yet to be determined?
Well, there's a great deal we don't know. What we've been told after having really our expectations lowered after the end of the talks on Saturday, that there were still obstacles. We learned today, well, in fact, there is an outline here of a peace treaty. I must say what it strikes me as, we're trying to put the best face on what is still a very difficult way forward here. There are major obstacles. And what they apparently have agreed to is a sort of exchange that we might have expected. We know what the U.S. first priority is, and that is security of the homeland, which means al-Qaeda. It means terrorists. And it has always pressed the Taliban to renounce al-Qaeda, which they have refused to do. And at the same time saying, well, of course, we have no ties with them anymore, but they have never been willing to say that they would never have ties with them. And in any event, they have now apparently agreed to disassociating themselves from the Taliban and also pledging that no terrorist groups would be able to use Afghanistan to attack any other country. The trouble with that is, can they really guarantee that? Would they have the kind of control enable for them to do this? Well, we're talking about here, presumably down the road, is a power-sharing arrangement. So really, they're not in a position to make any promises unless, of course, they had complete power. And then, as I suggest, even then they would be in a position where they would have to have really complete control of the country. And then also the desire to, in fact, after the U.S. had left and presumably an Afghan government had collapsed, to follow through in denying others whose agenda, whose Islamic agenda, is not entirely unlike their own. They would have to say, well, you know, we have an Islamic State here in Kabul, but we really don't care. In fact, we're not in any way going to support bringing Islam and the Sharia to Tajikistan or Uzbekistan or Pakistan or Iran.
The U.S. negotiator, Zalmay Khalilzad, is saying that the Taliban must make a number of concessions, and one is that they have to agree to talk directly with the Afghan government, which up to this point they have opposed, and some of their also peripheral groups have opposed in the past. Do you see that happening, and if so, why now?
Well, look, that is a major sticking point here. In all of this optimism here, there's no indication, in fact, that the Taliban are prepared to change their position on that. They consider the Kabul government, an illegitimate stooge government, if you want, call it that way.
Of the United States, right.
This is what, now, they have said, and so there's no change here. They have said right along, but we will talk to Afghans, meaning that we have no particular problem with talking to those Afghans who want to talk to us. It's just that this government, and you can read beyond that, this government and its political system are unacceptable to us. Now, it's more than simply legitimacy of the Kabul government, because what we're talking about here is a political system here that they have never shown any interest in participating in. And that means that in a power-sharing arrangement, that they would find that they were willing to run in elections, put up, you know, create a political party, hold cabinet positions, serve as governor. They have made it pretty clear, and they've done nothing through these negotiations to suggest that in any way they have changed their basic view that ultimately what they want, whether they get it in one step or five steps, they want the restoration of an Islamic emirate, what they had, they would argue, in the 1990s.
Is Pakistan involved here? And if so, how so?
Well, Pakistan has what you could call spoiler power. It has the capacity here to throw a monkey wrench into anything which is appearing to solidify into an agreement if they think that that agreement is against their interests. They want very much to have a place at the table here when it comes to the final terms here. And mostly that's about, they're worrying about India's having an outsized role in Afghanistan. But Pakistan, and whether you go back to the 90s or since, Pakistan has never been able to do more than pressure the Taliban. And with this, they've had a great deal of difficulty, but they have succeeded now, as they did in 2015, to get the Middle East to come to the table. And that's what that reveals in their willingness to come to the table, is that there are elements within the Pakistan, within the Taliban, that, and I think those elements are stronger now than they've been in the past, that are willing to envision a political outcome here. That is, they don't see the result necessarily having to be a military victory. If they can secure the kind of state that they ultimately want, and if they could do so politically, all the better. And that point of view, I think, is what has changed in time, and that's why they are at the table in Doha, because they see the possibility, because they have succeeded to the degree they have militarily, that they have created the conditions now here to get a very favorable settlement. But again, we have no indication that it is going to be on any but their terms. And I'm suggesting those terms do not include someone like Ashraf Ghani or anyone like Ashraf Ghani being head of state, head of government. Theirs is a very different conception of what a righteous government should be.
You talked about this at the top. One of the details from the Taliban's pledge is preventing international terrorist organizations from using Afghan soil as a launching pad. Can the Taliban really make that pledge? And how tenuous or how substantive would a pledge of, and long-lasting, would a pledge of that nature be?
Well, once the U.S. forces have departed and a Kabul government is left to its own devices, it's impossible for anyone to hold the Taliban's feet to the fire with anything they agree to. Look, there's how many times have we seen in Afghanistan and Pakistan agreements reached which were breached in the shortest of time? There's, you know, there's a history here of pledges that completely fall apart. So it's not as though you have two states of with international reputations that have a word about international recognition of them and their being respected in the international order. These are organizations here which will which can't agree to anything. Let me say that in that regard, I hold that the Taliban have been rather admirable. They have, up until this point, not, as they might have, agreed to things that they were intending to break. That when they have said, we don't want to talk, they could have very well said, all right, let's talk, and we'll strike agreements, and we'll lead you down a garden path here, expecting, but they have never played that game here. Whether they're playing it now, I don't know. But I would say that if they are, they feel that they're doing it from a position of strength. And as far as the United States is concerned, they are prepared to give the United States enough so that it is able to cater to public opinion in this country, particularly the president's own apparent inclinations here to leave. They know that they have an American president and a good deal of feeling in the United States that we've got to find a way out. In fact, a desperation almost to find a way out. So Khalilzad is there to bring back enough to justify then the exit of American troops.
That was my next question. Is this really the Trump administration looking for a politically and media journalistic acceptable way out, and then whatever happens in Afghanistan happens in Afghanistan?
Well, look, I think we'll fool ourselves into believing that we can come back in when we need to deal with terrorist threats and so on. But once you've left and you don't have the intelligence on the ground mm-hmm. to guide you, and if by your leaving you undermine the Afghan security forces, as I think everybody would recognize as a very distinct possibility, then you really don't have very many options. Now, we really are looking for a way out. The word I use in something I wrote today is we're looking for a graceful way out.
Yes.
It's one that we need cover for it. And so we'll grasp on to these overtures, which, as I say, are neither going to be enforceable or for that matter, are really satisfactory at this point, since they are unlikely to join the current government. We'll grasp on those the way it looks now, if we get enough. Now, having said that, I will say that Ambassador Khalilzad has said that he's going to stand ground when it comes to not talking to the Kabul government. He said that. And we'll if he holds to that, then it's nothing. He's not going to be able to deliver anything. But if they find some way to finesse that, then they will, because he was sent there to bring back enough to make a withdrawal palatable.
My final question to you, and Dr. Marvin Weinbaum, thank you. You're the director of the Afghan and Pakistan Studies at the Middle East Institute. Thank you for your time. My final question to you, back in, I want to say, July or August, China was reported to be courting Afghan Taliban in meetings, I believe, in Doha. And so is China a player in this today, even though that's not being reported in mainstream American media?
All of the regional powers, close neighbors and distant neighbors, all at this point, and that means Iran and Russia and China and, of course, Pakistan, have hedging strategies. They are preparing for the day that either the Taliban will be dominant in the country, or even more to their concern, that there is a chaotic civil war. They are doing what they can to ready their own security toward that kind of outcome. And so the hedging strategy here is that they have set up links to the Taliban. They don't want to see a Taliban victory outright. That serves none of their purposes. They would love to see the Taliban submerged in Afghan politics, in an agreement, which was enough for the U.S. to leave, not to have any permanent presence. That's their ideal here. But they're doing whatever they can to prepare for the day when the U.S. does leave, the Afghan state is facing military pressure, or because of a bad election, begins to collapse from within. What they can then hope to do to be able to secure, as I say, their own borders.
Dr. Marvin G. Weinbaum, Director, Afghanistan and Pakistan Studies at the Middle East Institute. Sir, thank you for your time this evening. Greatly, greatly appreciate you coming back to the Critical Hour.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Have a good evening. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We're back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. As government reopens, Trump casts doubt on prospects for a wall deal, and shutdown costs U.S. economy $11 billion, according to the Congressional Budget Office. The five-week federal government shutdown costs United States economy $11 billion, with nearly a quarter of that total permanently lost. The nonpartisan CBO said that the shutdown, which started in late December and ended last Friday, delayed $18 billion in spending by federal workers. That is expected to reduce 2018 fourth quarter gross domestic product by $3 billion and cut first quarter growth this year by $8 billion, or 0.2%. What does all this really mean? Well, for insight, let's turn to my next guest. First, he's a PhD and a professor in the Department of Economics, and he's an economist with the AFL-CIO, William Spriggs. Dr. Spriggs, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you for having me.
And my other guest is a PhD in political economy. He teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Dr. Rasmus, welcome back.
Good afternoon.
So let's start with the economics of this issue. The U.S. government was partially shut down for 35 days. Dr. Spriggs, your thoughts on the logic behind this and the damage done. Again, the five-week federal government shutdown, according to the CBO, cost the U.S. economy $11 billion, with nearly a quarter of that total permanently lost. Your thoughts, sir?
I think that may be an understatement of what's lost, because the slowdown in acquisitions are going to have ripple effects as well. People forget when we've done previous shutdowns that the workers were absent a week, and in a week the meat of what they do wasn't lost because they quickly got back to work and up to speed and made up for the lost time. This time, not being able to make contracts has strained a number of people. Processes slowed. We already know there are backups for people getting Section 8 housing. When you slow up the whole process, that makes that line get longer. And we know that there are going to be problems even with contracting going forward because this is a continuing resolution only for 3 weeks. So the agencies don't have a full picture of what their budgets are going to look like, so they still have to be wary about some contracts that they're doing. So I think it's going to be bigger than what the CBO said. I think that was a good conservative estimate of the downside. We don't know how much it's really going to be. You still have, because it's only 3 weeks, most federal workers are still very wary of any major purchases. This is going to slow housing sales, slow car sales, and their tightening of their belts means that it hurts some vulnerable industries like restaurants, beauty salons, the type of thing where if you're going to save money, those are the types of things that you cut from your budget.
The discretionary side of your budget?
The ultra-discretionary side of your budget. Because remember now, because the workers went a month without a paycheck, and many of them were using free food that was being offered them here locally in D.C. by Andres and his outfit that fed Puerto Rico. And people have been going to food pantries. So even something less discretionary, right? They're very wary, even on something as basic as food that you would cook at home. So having that instability is going to be great. Now, having said all that, remember 800,000 people, that's like a very big American city. It's a very big size American city. And we just have to remember we shut down New Orleans because of Katrina. And it was hard to see a big showing in the national GDP because of it. I think this may be a little different. 800,000 is bigger than the city of New Orleans. The number of contractors who didn't get paid makes it much bigger. And the federal workforce is spread out more than in one city. So I think this slower growth for the quarter may be enough for us to really see it, and it may be too much. It may be too much uncertainty put into the market at this time.
Dr. Rasmus, same question to you and to Dr. Spriggs's point about the 800,000 federal employees. That's just those that were directly employed by the government. That doesn't count contract workers and other 1099 workers, for example.
Well, if you look at the CBO estimates, what they're estimating is the consumption of 800,000 workers during the five-week period. Now, that's a very, very narrow base to estimate the economic impact, because even for the 800,000 workers, their consumption is going to be very muted going forward, especially since we know this is only for 3 weeks, and they've loaded up on debt. And the more you have on debt, you've got to pay your interest on the debt, the less you have in discretionary consumption spending. So even for that 800,000, it's going to have a carry-on effect, and we don't know how big that's going to happen. Now, what's also missing in the CBO is an estimation of the rest of the economy, the impact. And again, it creates great uncertainty, especially since this thing is only for 3 weeks and most likely will happen again. And we already see consumer confidence plummeting in the first quarter here. And because of, in part, this uncertainty, there's other factors as well. But in other words, there's a spillover effect on consumption elsewhere, and consumption's about almost 70% of the economy. At the same time, we see business confidence also taking a significant dip. And that's unknown, too. Businesses, many of which are affected by government contracts directly and indirectly, see that maybe they won't get paid in the coming months, they're not going to invest.
they're not going to expand production. They may even cut back production. So you're going to have an impact on investment as well as on consumption in general from this effect. There's a ballooning effect and a spillover over time effect, and there's no way that the CBO can estimate that accurately. So this thing is much bigger than they say, and you know it's going to happen again, I really believe, because Trump is really the president of 35% of the country, and this is a litmus test for him to get this wall. He's not going to give up. He doesn't really care the impact on the rest of the country, I believe. And, you know, that attitude that is going to result in another shutdown in whole or part. This has been wholly tactical on his part to make it look like, oh, he's making concessions so that 3 weeks from now, he can pull the plug on a national emergency therefore get his way, probably, because we're going to be right in the middle of the budget negotiations beginning, or the budget will come out. And, you know, games are being played here. And I really think that this thing is not over. And people know that. People aren't stupid. Business people, consumers, they know this thing is probably not over. And that's going to have a big effect on confidence, and that's going to impact the economy as well.
Dr. Spriggs, you mentioned food kitchens. Jack mentioned interest on debt from loans that folks were having to take out in order to cover not having two paychecks. But Wilbur Ross scratches his head. He's totally perplexed and befuddled. Why would people have to go to food kitchens? And you can just really go to a bank and take out a loan. What is the problem?
Yeah, well, he needs to be welcome to the real world. He forgets that we call it a liquidity trap or liquidity constraint for individuals. And some people have already borrowed to the limit and can't borrow more. And then other people are in sensitive positions in the government, and they have big issues if they go and borrow money. This is something highlighted by the FBI, all of who every FBI agent has to go through a security clearance. Going in debt is frowned upon. And
they have to give a financial statement every year.
Yes, they have to give a financial statement every year. But in addition to that, their credit score, if it goes south, affects their clearance.
Right, that's my point. They have to give a financial report every year, and an impact such as this on their credit rating would definitely damage their security. My point is just that this is an ongoing process for them. A lot of people would think, oh, they go through a security clearance to get the job, but no, they got to go through security clearances to keep the job.
To keep the job. And as you said, every year they go through a security clearance. So for a large number of federal workers, that is a non-starter. And the loss, if they did borrow the money, you know, as we just heard, right, they are going to have to pay interest. So some of them who were more pessimistic filed for unemployment insurance and probably got one or two unemployment checks. They're going to have to pay those back, fortunately not with interest. But that loss of income is something that just won't come back into the economy and be spent to help keep other people employed. We don't know what's going to happen to some of these companies that were contractors, because they rely on those workers being in place for the company to survive. A month without revenue, it's going to be pretty tough on some of them, and they're not going to make that up. And so it's not clear how stable those government contractors are going to be who are doing the direct personnel work. And so the ramifications, again, it's going to ripple for some time. The auto industry already had slowed down because of the increases in the interest rates that the Federal Reserve has put in place. And as a result, we peaked in auto sales back in October. They've remained level at 18 million a year, but that's a number that makes General Motors go lay off some workers. because it's not an expanding market, it's just a stable market. And they didn't want to, General Motors didn't want to be caught with too many workers. So that type of freezing the market, the, you know, people give up things like groceries and eating out, but you definitely don't buy a new car. And with the threat hanging over people that in 3 weeks this could repeat itself, you know, you're delaying auto sales for 3 months on the part of large numbers of people. It's not a smart thing to have done, particularly over a really bad policy idea. To insult a neighboring friendly country, and that is what the president has done, and he says he needs the wall for reasons that are clearly racist. It's not good policy. It's not in the interest of the United States. And this isn't the way to conduct our business. It's a danger going forward. So the problem isn't just now, but the fact that he would do a stunt like this over a stupid policy means that there's more uncertainty to come. We had two shutdowns while the Republicans were in control of Congress. So this isn't a partisan issue. This has to do with the instability of the person who's in the presidency. And since he's going to be there, this current threat shows that that instability, the fact that he had two shutdowns under Republican Congresses, that instability is going to be there coming going forward.
And Dr. Rasmus, the president has already told us, even though the government's reopened, and you talked about this at the top, but I want to get back to you. Folks, we're talking with Dr. Jack Rasmus, professor of economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California, and Dr. William Spriggs, a professor in the Department of Economics at Howard University and an economist with the AFL-CIO. Jack, you had mentioned about the ongoing negotiations with the threat of shutting the government down again on the 15th. So the president's already poisoned the well by telling folks, I don't really expect an agreement to come forward. And to Dr. Spriggs's point, it's really a stupid policy. So we're on the verge of this happening again and happening within by the 15th of February.
Well, look, this is a political lockout. You know, in the private sector, when you have negotiations and the employer wants to punish the workers and harm them financially before they may go on strike or take a strike vote, he says you can't come to work. And that's just what Trump has done. This is the first political lockout, I think, in U.S. history, very clearly. It's not just the shutdown. And, you know, in this whole effort, I believe, is just a tactical move, as I said, on his part, to make himself look like he's making concessions. And then in 3 weeks, once again, he'll be ready to pull the plug. Now, a lot of it depends upon, you know, other major events going on. And, you know, that includes the trade war, which could come to a head about then. But we could see a situation where, you know, you got the trade war. China walks away for a while. I think they'll come to an agreement eventually, but they may not come to agreement by March 1st. And then you got another lockout. And then the first quarter of the year, GDP is always, for seasonal reasons, exceptionally low. I think there's seasonality adjustment problems in the Commerce Department here. But you know, we could have a kind of a perfect storm coming together at the end of February here, which isn't good considering that the economy is teetering right now. Dr. Spriggs mentioned the auto industry. Well, the housing construction industry is in the same boat. And if you look at what's happened to the stock markets, they're churning. The bull bounce to what is a bear market in the stock market appears it may be coming to an end. You've got Europe that's slipping fast into another recession. You've got China that's slowing down. All this could precipitate a general shift in confidence and consciousness on the part of both business and consumers. And we could see ourselves slipping into an early recession before, as I predicted, the end of 2019. It could happen all because of bad policy moves here on the part of Trump. It's not very smart.
We just have about 2 minutes, a minute for each of you. We've got breaking news that John Bolton is now calling on world leaders to back Guaido in Venezuela and calling on Maduro to step down. And both of you being economists, I wanted to get your, and Treasury Secretary Mnuchin was standing at the podium as well, talking about sanctions against Venezuela. And Bolton is saying that we have evidence of corruption in the Maduro regime and that all options are on the table. Really quickly, Dr. Spriggs, your thoughts on what's going on in Venezuela?
Well, I think it just adds to the uncertainty by having the U.S. intervene in a way that is likely to create even more instability in an unstable situation that Venezuela is facing. And that's not going to help the economy.
Dr. Jack Rasmus, your thoughts?
Yes, well, this is Bolton's in premature written all over it here. This is the neocons upping the attempt to destabilize and regime change in Venezuela. The U.S. has been putting the screws to Venezuela for some time, particularly by various moves denying it the dollar currency for its economy, which raises the cost of imports and inflation and leads to layoffs. The U.S. has been setting, for at least two years now, setting the stage for what Bolton's doing. But it's important to understand that they wouldn't be doing this if they didn't have this recent overturn in Brazil.
In Brazil, right.
In Bolsonaro. Mm-hmm. Bolsonaro now, of course, immediately comes out and says he'll send troops, and they're lining up the OAS behind Bolsonaro. And it's you know, it may come to that. It may come to a military invasion, and they're making the preparations. You can see it across the board here. It was no different than 2003 when they were preparing. And this could destabilize everything. But, you know, it's a good distraction from the domestic economic problems, which will likely accelerate here throughout the rest of this year in the U.S.
Dr. William Spriggs, professor in the Department of Economics at Howard University and economist with the AFL-CIO. Thank you, Dr. Jack Rasmus, economics professor at St. Mary's College in California. Thank you as well. Thank you for coming to the Critical Hour.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and an hour ago, this was breaking news. John Bolton calls on world leaders to back Juan Guaido in Venezuela and calls on Maduro to step down. And Treasury Secretary Mnuchin calls on the United States providing greater sanctions on Venezuela to change the behavior of President Maduro. For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's been a human rights activist for more years than for all of his life, and former professor in the African American Studies Department at Temple University, and one of the renowned experts on the works of W.E.B. Du Bois, Dr. Anthony Montero. Dr. Montero, thank you so much on such short notice coming to the Critical Hour.
Thank you very much, Will. No problem.
So when you turn on your television today and you hear John Bolton calling on the world to back Juan Guaido in Venezuela and for Maduro to step down, your thoughts?
My thoughts are that Maduro and the Venezuelan government will widen its international support as the days and weeks go forward. This recent, what I consider desperate move on the part of the Trump administration, and in particular John Bolton and his closest political ally on this, Senator Marco Rubio, comes in the face of the fact that the Venezuelan government and the people of Venezuela will harden their resolve to defend their sovereignty and the right to self-determination. These sanctions are hitting them hard. Clearly, there is a sense by the Venezuelan people that this is economic warfare from the Yankee imperialists against their nation. I think they will suffer, but they will come out better off than had they buckled down and submitted to this pressure from the United States and some of its Western allies.
You said to us, I believe we were talking on Friday, it was either Thursday or Friday, and you said to us that you saw Marco Rubio as really being the one calling this shot, and that was a surprise to me. And then on the 26th, the headline in the New York Times, on Venezuela, Rubio assumes U.S. role of ouster in chief. And just the first two paragraphs, his hands chopping in the air, his voice stern and stalwart, he declared that it was time for the regional despot to go and warned of the consequences if he did not. With a commander-in-chief's resolve, he vowed that the United States would do whatever it took to protect its own diplomats on the ground. It was not the commander-in-chief, but Senator Marco Rubio, the Florida Republican, who nearly 3 years after losing his own bid for the presidency has become a lead policy architect and de facto spokesman in a daring and risky campaign involving the United States in the unrest that is now gripping Venezuela. Why is Rubio, according to the New York Times and to you before they wrote the piece, why is Rubio the front man on this? Bolton we saw today, Mnuchin we saw today, hadn't seen Trump on this one.
Yeah, and it's very interesting. Why Marco Rubio? It's South Florida, first of all. His political base consists essentially of Latin American counter-revolutionaries. They finance him, and they're the ones that want to take over the state-owned and state-controlled oil company that is really the property of the people of Venezuela, and privatize it and loot the people in the interest of a small class of capitalists in Venezuela and their allies in the banks in South Florida, by the way. Not, you know, we have to be very specific here. I'd like to say, it's going to fail. If this is their plan B, if plan A was that weak rally and that they held and then declaring this guy Guaido the president, if that was plan A, it failed miserably. And if plan B is this, it will also fail. See, the thing I think we have to understand, besides U.S. presidential politics in 2020, and of course, the Florida electoral votes are very, very important. So this is partially a strategy of winning Florida, but it's also Marco Rubio serving his counter-revolutionary Cuban and Venezuelan and other South American forces who live between South America and South Florida. But the other thing here, and this I think is decisive. In 2017, the Venezuelan people, under the leadership of the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, elected a constituent assembly. That constituent assembly has rewrote the Constitution. In other words, the legal framework for the exercise of state power and, of course, of individual and group rights within the framework of this form of state power. It was to begin the process of restructuring the political system in Venezuela. That's one side of it. The military, I believe, will stand firm because they are stakeholders in this new formation. The second thing, and I think this is highly important, Venezuela has new allies in the world. It is not just beleaguered Cuba. It is not just Bolivia and a few other South American countries, but now China and Russia. These are big countries. They play a huge role on the world stage. And hence, I am of the opinion that Venezuela, unlike 2002, when the coup was carried out against Hugo Chavez, Venezuela, in spite of the economic war of the United States, is in a better position in the world community than it's ever been.
That's a fantastic assessment. I want to read one more paragraph from this New York Times article. Through sheer force of will and a concerted effort to engage and educate President Trump, Marco Rubio has made himself, in effect, a virtual Secretary of State for Latin America, driving administration strategy and articulating it to the region from the Senate floor. I found it interesting. I can't recall the New York Times referencing or referring to President Obama as having needed to be educated on an issue. I don't recall the New York Times, and for as silly as George W. Bush was and as ignorant as he is, I don't recall them saying that he ever had to be educated on an issue. And so now we have the New York Times saying that Rubio is educating Trump and has made himself, in effect, a virtual Secretary of State, as though there's so much confusion within the Trump administration that a sitting American senator can just inject himself into foreign policy as Marco Rubio. Am I overreading this?
I don't think you are. And I think what we're looking at is a deep struggle within the administration and a struggle between Trump, the individual, and the national security state. Obviously, we know that Bolton represents that. Obviously, Pompeo. Trump's instincts, as in Syria, as in Afghanistan, is imperial retreat. He ran on that. No intervention and regime change. He said it multiple times. If you read Bob Woodward's book on the Trump presidency called Fear, he talks about his Trump's national security team taking him in early 2017 to this meeting at the Pentagon, where the top generals and so on said to Trump that we cannot afford and we cannot, in the name of American security, retreat from our positions of being the military hegemon in the world. And Bob Woodward recounts that Trump jumped up and walked out and said he didn't agree with any of them. Over the last 2 years, there has been a prolonged process of whittling down his opposition to regime change and this imperial overreach, if you want to call it that. Well, it seems that on Venezuela, they have gotten him where they want him. And that's why I think all of the variables have to be considered. The 2020 election, the electoral votes of Florida, Marco Rubio as the senator from Florida, and that's one side of it. But the other side of it is that the deep state, the national security state, who wants to flex their muscles and wants to bring Trump under their wing, under their influence. I think this is what this represents. But again, I would say I believe it's going to fail. I think that the forces opposing Maduro in Venezuela do not have the stomach for an all-out and prolonged struggle for power against the existing government and against the existing state structures.
Now, Bolton says that all options are on the table. And
right.
I understand that in Brazil, Bolsonaro is talking about, if need be, sending troops into Venezuela. Is that bluster and jingoistic saber rattling? Or do you see a scenario where Bolsonaro is the tip of the spear with Bolton and Pompeo with their hands on the shaft?
Yeah. Interesting question. You might also be aware that the Colombian government said over the weekend that they would not allow their country to be a base right. operation in Venezuela, military operation.
That was going to be my next question. So go ahead, Tony.
Yeah. So the other thing is that Bolsonaro's government is a very weak government in Brazil. This could push him over the edge into being a minority government and face all kinds of protests within Brazil. The other thing is, by starving the Venezuelan nation, you are creating a refugee crisis for all of the neighboring countries around Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not just an attack upon Venezuela. It's an attack upon its neighboring countries. But larger than that, you know, the South American people have a good memory of the whole history of U.S. intervention, toppling of governments. We can mention, if you wish, the assassination and overturning of the government of Salvador Allende in Chile. Without going much further, we can talk about the Dominican Republic and on and on and on. There is, among the South American people, left and center, and yes, even among some right-wing forces, a dislike of Yankee imperialism, of this arrogance of white Americans coming into South America and dictating what their politics should be. The other thing, and this is, of course, something that is seldom talked about, the U.S. is a promoter of white supremacy in the nations of South America. If you look at the rallies supporting Guaido, supporting the overturning of the government in Venezuela, it is overwhelmingly white people marching. That is not the complexion of Venezuela. Then you look at the much larger demonstration supporting Maduro, you see what Venezuelan actually look like. And that is kind of common in a good part of South America, where the United States installs governments that don't look like the people that they claim to be governing. So I just don't see a win for the United States. They can make it difficult for Venezuela, but Venezuela has allies in Africa, in Asia, and in much of South America.
You know, you mentioned the United States supporting white interests in South America. You had the United States and European colonial powers supporting minority tribal interests in African countries, imposing them upon the larger tribal interests, hence being their henchmen and exacting incredibly just outright brutality because you have a minority who's now in charge of the majority.
Absolutely. And I think the most dramatic expression of what you just said in Africa is the Paul Kagame regime in Rwanda. That is a minority tribal regime, which is almost an authoritarian and fascist regime over the majority in that country. But see, again, you know, you attack a country like Venezuela, it is an attack upon Latin America itself.
Right.
And Latin American people understand that. I'm just waiting for the response of China and Russia, hopefully India, who will eventually establish trade relationships for oil with Venezuela. And here's the other thing, Will, that they will move from the petrodollar to the petroyuan. That is, China and Venezuela will trade in oil in a currency that has nothing to do with the U.S. dollar. The same thing between Russia and Venezuela. They will trade in the petroruble. And eventually, through these new market relationships, a new economy will emerge in Venezuela. And I predict in the not that distant future, Venezuela will once again thrive economically and socially, but it will be a new economy in a new global economy. The United States does not have the political consensus to carry out the Bolton Marco Rubio strategy of regime change in Venezuela. More than that, Trump is not in it. He does not have the stomach for it. But let us add another dimension. The United States itself is in the throes of a legitimacy crisis. We are split between left and right. The center has collapsed. There is no consensus on any questions of foreign policy. And on this matter, it's Bolton and Marco Rubio, and I think it's going to fail because there's not much support for it in the broader political elite or the population as a whole.
Let me close with, you talked about, you wonder what Russia's response is going to be. Well, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo called on all members of the U.N. Security Council on Saturday to support Venezuela's democratic transition, as he called it. He spoke of the desperate conditions in Venezuela, where protests in the past week have turned deadly. The Trump administration is urging the world to follow its lead to recognize Guaido as the nation's legitimate interim leader. But, this is from CBS, support in the council was divided, and an effort to have a statement approved failed before the meeting began. Russia's ambassador, Vasily Nebenzia, called the U.S. attempt to pass a statement an unethical ploy, said the Trump administration's support for Guaido is a coup d'etat.
Absolutely.
We have just a minute left, Tony. I think that answers that question. Man, I called on you today because I knew I'd get the analysis that I did. You gave me more time than I had asked you and that you had agreed to give me. But I greatly, greatly appreciate it, man. And as always, thank you for coming to the Critical Hour.
And thank you very much, and keep up the great work you're doing, Will.
With contacts like you, I have no option. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hey, folks, this was, again, an hour ago or so, this was breaking news, but you've been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.